Good afternoon. It's just after 5 o'clock in London, England, and from the snow-covered mountains of BC, my guest this week is, in the morning his time, is Kirk Morrison. Kirk and I know each other pretty well. We've worked together in two capacities. One, in his past corporate life as a senior executive with a global engineering services company. He's been based out of Alberta, but worked globally. Alberta is very much known for the oil and gas industry, and I'm sure that'll be a topic of conversation. We've also worked with his charity, which is the Canadian Pulmonary Fibrosis Foundation, which has been very fulfilling work for both of us, I know. And I've not seen Kirk in person for a while with COVID, a couple of years, but it's a pleasure to see you on video, sir. How are you?
I'm great, Tom. It's good to see you. I wished you Happy New Year before. It's still appropriate because I haven't seen you this year yet.
So there you go.
Doing well.
So perhaps just introduce, tell the audience a little bit about yourself. And then the topic for this, as with all of my weekly guests, is just, what's happening and what's next? What's on your mind?
Well, it's nice to meet everybody virtually. I hope you're all doing well. I'm a civil engineer. Was born in Eastern Canada. I moved to Alberta in 1982 just because many of you will remember there was a recession going on then, and that was the only place I got a job. And when you move to Alberta, you invariably end up working in the oil and gas industry, which I did. And then over the years, I went back and did a master's in environmental engineering just because I was interested in that. Was an emerging field at the time. And then I got into consulting, and I've consulted ever since 1988, largely in the energy and resource sector. And that's where I met Tom. During my employment at Stantec, and Tom and I worked together because I was looking for a coach. And Tom was really helpful to me both in my job and personally. So I retired from Stantec at the end of 2020, largely because I wanted to do some work on the energy transition and the energy remix, as I'll describe it a little later. I'm doing a project through an NGO called the Canadian Energy and Climate Nexus on, the whole energy transition, and does it make business sense? And can it drive the Canadian economy going forward? And, our thesis is that it can. But I'm also, since I retired doing this project, I've also got involved in a couple of startup companies, both in the green energy business. One is a large energy storage facility, a pump storage facility in Northern Ontario. And the other is hydrogen and clean fuels production in Western Canada. And both I'm involved in those, and both have been very, I've got some great opportunities, but they've got their own, they've got their own challenges, and we can talk a bit about those in the overall context. And finally, I told Tom I'm building a new house. And I said I was going to build a net zero house. I'm going solar and geothermal. And from what all my consultants and contractors tell me, I'm going to be net zero. But I can, Tom, I can share some of the, if we have time, I can share some of my findings on that too as well.
Cool. So there's a very much a topic around energy. I was just up in Aberdeenshire in Scotland before Christmas, visiting some close friends up there. And their oil was in the North Sea, and it's now kind of almost in runoff because the fields for the oil and the gas are restricted. But of course the lens of the people in that industry are, we need to keep it going. And at a political level, at some level, some of the politicians are going, no, we just need to shut it off. Because there's a big new field that has been found, and there is pressure not to open it up and develop it. So I was really interested, and Alberta is very much centered on energy and what the stock markets are going to start to call extractive industries. It's not very sexy and fashionable anymore. but it's been a big part of the Canadian economy. So I've been reading what you've been looking at. I know you went away and did a whole bunch of academic study and research before you got into working with this NGO. But tell me about this remix idea, because that's not something I've heard much on the European side or the North Sea oil side of this equation. But I quite like remix as a concept and transition. So just maybe tell people a bit about that as a starter.
Yeah, so our thesis is that the energy remix can really drive the Canadian economy going forward. And so we've specifically called it the remix, and it consists of two elements. It's firstly, it's the, you know, what I think most people would call the energy transition, but I've said the remix consists of two elements. First is replace, and replace is replacing hydrocarbons with electrons derived from low greenhouse sources, greenhouse gas sources, solar, wind, hydro, biomass, hydrogen, geothermal, nuclear, whatever. But replacing hydrocarbons with electrons is the primary energy supply. So that's replace. The second element of it is restoring hydrocarbons as a raw material for manufacturing the products that the world needs. So there's two elements to the remix. It's replace, and the second element's restore. So we're not going to burn hydrocarbons. And I guess in real layman's terms, we're not going to burn hydrocarbons going forward to make energy. Instead, we're going to make stuff out of them that everybody wants.
Mm-hmm. So with that, we're still going to extract them from the ground, right?
Yeah, I think so, Tom. Mm-hmm. You know, the work that we did is we did a real comprehensive review of the Canadian energy system. We compared it to, you know, created a number of metrics and compared it to other countries and regions. We surveyed 69 government bodies in Canada, all the provinces, the territories, and municipalities, you know, having populations of over 100,000. We surveyed 46 engineering companies. We surveyed 174 financial institutions. So we did the banks, PE, and bench DC firms. We surveyed a bunch of NGOs. And, you know, so we found a couple of things. And to your question, like right now, of all the crude oil Canada produces, and Canada's like fifth largest crude oil producer in the world, and we're the primary supplier to America. But of the crude oil we produce, 21% of that is currently used as a component for making something. It's coming out of a manufactured product, be it plastics, be it asphalt, whatever. So 21% of it right now isn't burned. And then you start looking, and the demand for those products globally is increasing at a rate of about 4% per year.
Hmm.
So if I've done my math right and all my exponents and that sort of stuff, if that continues in 40 years, about 40 years, 100% of the current Canadian crude oil production could be used for making stuff, with none of it used for energy production. And that's not saying what's going to happen. That's just strictly math. 21% we're using as we're making stuff right now. If that demand for that increases 4% per year and 40% a year, we might not have stuff to make to burn for energy.
And that's fascinating because the, you know, I've had at least one or two guests on here with a focus on last year COP26. And COP26, as you'll know, the big focus there was on CO2 emissions. Right? I mean, that's the primary focus to the humans to address the climate crisis is to reduce our level of CO2 emissions. So there, of course, there are CO2 emissions used in extraction and manufacturing, but by far the biggest is, and I'm speaking in layman's terms as I understand them, I'm not an expert, you clearly are, is in reducing burning of hydrocarbons. So I love the fact you've simplified and distilled it. And it is fascinating. You know, we are going to still need them. We've become very dependent upon hydrocarbons for production of plastics and many products. So that's fascinating. And then just looking at it from a, you know, the, from a Canadian perspective, clearly, as you've outlined, you've deeply researched it, yourself and the body you're working with, the project. So it's just, to me, that's just, the whole thing is a fascinating shift and just saying remix. I'm originally from Scotland, and Scotland are among the world leaders on percentage of power from renewables, but for reasons similar to Canada. You've got great strategic advantages on things like, you mentioned pump storage, you've got things like hydro already there, right? And Scotland will be one of the leaders in tidal power because they just already have it, and they have tons of wind. So that almost every hillside in Scotland has got a turbine on it, right? So they're, most of the year, they're already over 100% renewables for electric generation. But it's an interesting perspective rather than just saying we need to stop all the oil extraction and production. Then actually, looking at it from the Canadian perspective, I like your piece around if there's a 4% annual growth rate within 40 years, all of the existing production, if it remains at that level, would be used not to burn it, but to use it in producing products that the world needs. It's a really interesting perspective.
Yeah. And Tom, we followed China very carefully. And when you start talking to the Chinese people who are in the industry, they have a similar opinion. They're probably a little more blunt with it. They say that the demand for products that use hydrocarbons as a base, the global demand is such that we can't afford to keep burning the stuff, that there just isn't the resource available.
We're going to need it. We're going to need it for production, not burning. Yeah.
Do both. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. So anyway, that's the one element. And the other thing we found, and I'll put a little bit of a plug in for the Canadian energy industry is Canada produces a lot of energy and Canadians use a lot of energy. But when you aggregate it all together, the emissions intensity, i.e. the amount of CO2 that actually gets emitted from a kilowatt hour of Canadian energy is very low relative to the global average. Like it's about a third lower. So we've gone out and said, if Canada supplied 100% of the world's energy, global emissions would drop by a third overnight. So that is the opportunity for the country is to continue to produce energy in the diverse mix that we do and make it even greener, but export it. Anyway, those are kind of the two main findings is that Canadian energy, even though we produce a lot of it, we use a lot of it, and an aggregate, it's very clean relative to the rest of the world. And that there's a huge opportunity for us to make stuff out of it, if we don't burn it. So those are kind of the two things I've kind of concluded from.
That's fair. I mean, it's very cool. And obviously I've worked with you and with others and other companies in Canada over the years. So I've become quite familiar with the Canadian economy. But many people listening to this won't be. And they go, oh, there's a ton of new stuff I'm learning here. Mm-hmm. And one of the things to me is sharing learnings and expertise. I'm from the Cayman Islands. I spent most of my adult life there. And all of the water in Cayman is produced from desalinated seawater. There's no fresh water. And what's actually happened is there's a company which, as it happens, is listed on the Toronto Stock Exchange. A relatively small company that are the experts in this. Well, they've expanded over the years and they consult all over the world on this. So there is the export of product and there's the export of learnings like you're sharing with Chinese people in the industry. And overall, the theme for me comes back to when we used to work together when you were with Stantec was like, how can we do things better? And if we're going to do it, how can we do it well? One of the projects you were involved in was pipeline development, which is always politically touchy. But I remember you used to post quite publicly about it and just say, look, when we're doing this, we're going to do it to the highest international standards and we're going to do it with safety in mind and all of that. So it's like the world of radicals when it comes to things like climate, and it's totally understand where they're coming from. But business people like you and I are going to go, well, how can we move the world forward in a practical way? And how can business thrive? And how can people thrive? And how can we find that balance? So it's, I think it's really good for the podcast audience to hear from a very senior global executive who's clearly passionate about, make changes in transition and remix on this. It's really cool. So, now tell me how much money you're going to lose on your house.
Wow. Well, that's a good, so our house, right now it's, too bad I couldn't put this slide in this, maybe I'll send you a table afterwards, and if you can figure out how to post it, you can do that. But anyway, we're building a new house right now, and it's not a small house, but we've decided that we want to be net zero. So right now in Alberta anyway, power largely comes from coal and natural gas with wind is being developed, but it's still in its early stages. Heating is through natural gas. So right now, if I was to build the house kind of the way my existing one was, I'd have a natural gas furnace, and then I'd have a service connection to the power grid, which is largely driven by hydrocarbons. So my house would emit probably about, I've worked it out, 21 tons a year of CO2. And my natural gas would cost me about $5,000 a year, and my power would cost me about $2,000 a year. So I'm going to put in, Tom, I'm going to put in solar panels. I've got a great south exposure on my roof. I'm going to put in a geothermal system. My engineer and my contractor say I will probably have to draw a little bit of power off the grid in November and December, you know, when the days are short, to power the geothermal heat pump. But other than that, I should be able to run the whole house, and I might export a bit of power. So right now, if I did it the conventional way, I'd spend probably $5,000 a year on natural gas, a couple of grand a year on power. I can get that down to, I'll still have a power bill, but I won't use, but just because I'm connecting to the grid, so I got to pay for, you know, grid infrastructure, but my bill will drop to about $800. Mm-hmm. Okay? So I'm going to save about $6,200 $6,200 a year. And this is with the increase in carbon taxes coming in Canada. But the whole thing is going to cost me $90,000 to put in. So I'm going to save $6,000, but spend $90,000. So it's a 15-year payout. And, you know, at that rate, you know as well as I, there's not many people doing things on 15-year payouts in the industry. So my point is that the business case for this probably, for some of it anyway, probably isn't all there yet. I think it'll come as things get more efficient, but it's not all there yet. And the results of our work at CECN kind of show that. They show that there's lots of interest in doing projects, but the project pipeline, the number of projects that are being contemplated that are getting financial, you know, that are achieving financial hurdles and that probably aren't enough at this stage anyway to get to that net zero by 2050. There's lots being contemplated, lots being done, but there probably aren't enough of them to get there. Now the financial industry, on the other hand, they've got lots of money out there to do this, but they got to make sense financially. So I'm seeing that with the two startups I'm working on. I'm seeing it with my house, and that is that the financials are really good for some projects, still challenging for others. And so I think that's kind of, I think, what we're going to end up concluding on this thing. That
let me share a couple of learnings from what's happening in the UK, because I lived most of my adult life in the Cayman Islands, and I've relocated to the UK, and the energy environment is very, very different. The energy, it's powering your house in the Cayman Islands is savagely expensive. Mm. Like, I would love to only pay 7,000 Canadian for my bills. The reality was my house was not small, and my bills would be more like $20,000 a year.
Yeah.
But when I first looked at putting photovoltaics out, like solar panels and stuff like that in there. It was, and it's for air conditioning, not heating. It would have been, the payback would have been not 15 years like you calculated, or less than 15 years. It would have been 25 years. So you're just not going to do it. Mm-hmm. I come here, and if I put it to you this way, my house is net zero. And I heat it with gas, natural gas. And I use electricity. And I have no solar panels or geothermal. So how's my house net zero? I buy all my power from renewable sources. Which is fascinating, because a quick bit for the listening audience, which are nothing new for you, but power from electric companies is separated into generation and transmission and distribution. Right. And
which is the same. Yeah. That's the same with us.
Yeah. It's the same everywhere, but I'm just saying it for the listening audience. And, so what's interesting is they totally deregulated power nationally in the UK a number of years ago. And they did. So you've got the same transmission lines, but wherever you live, you can choose where you get. And there's also natural gas pipes and stuff, right? Which is all, the great majority of the population have access to natural gas rather than propane tanks, and that's in the rural area. But you don't have to change anything in your house. You just go online and change your provider, and they buy it in bulk. Now, there's some massive problems right now because supply lines in Europe, and don't really know why, but the price of natural gas has trebled in the last year. So there are some massive regulatory hurdles, and companies are failing. But leave that to one side for the moment. The first thing they did was deregulate. And the second thing they did is they put an environmental levy on all of these companies, which is then used for subsidy of different things to create change. But I just thought it was interesting if the impetus is there. So as a piece, the average CO2 impact per person in the UK is not particularly low. It's actually quite similar to the Canadian level of carbon intensity per person. But what's interesting is you can choose to buy renewable power. And at the moment, the premium you pay is, well, when I put mine on a fixed contract, looking ahead in my crystal ball at gas price, natural gas prices, it was only about 5% more.
Mm-hmm.
So I didn't have any capital intensity, but it's just interesting because that's changing the industry. And as people's opinions start changing, there's a certain degree to which people are willing to pay for their principles and a certain degree to which they're not willing to pay for them, right? Mm-hmm. So I just thought, there may be some relevance to NGOs lobbying provincial and federal governments to actually look at all of that and go, and, you know, if you've got people who are working in wind and other forms of lower carbon impact power, actually not just saying we have our power company in Southern Alberta or something, but actually going, you can buy any from any one of eight national companies. So it's just sharing and learning. Of course, Cayman has a monopoly. Yeah. Which, and that's simply a matter of scale, to be honest. It's too small a place to have more than one company.
Yeah. Yeah. We've gone to we have a carbon tax here in Canada. It's a federally mandated, tax. It's implemented provincially. We have a carbon tax, and it started off at 20 bucks a ton. It's at 40 now. By 2030, they expect it to go to $170 a ton. And those numbers I talked about, you know, my cost of heating, my providing power to myself was $6,000. That's at $170 a ton. Right now, I'm probably about $3,500 a ton. So it's, the tax will be significant. But I think my analysis on this is it's not significant enough to get the hurdle rate to where, you know, someone who was looking at the real hard numbers for my situation anyway, wouldn't go and do it. So does that mean the tax is going to have to go higher? That'll be a very politically charged discussion.
Totally. I think what I'd be interested in, and just you can ask the question for me, because I'm into behavioral economics and nudging people's behavior and various things. And, one of an idea a friend of mine shared is, you may know, we have universal healthcare over here. So we pay a tax on income, but effectively everything at point of delivery is free, no deductibles, everything. But one of the issues is I had a CT scan for a routine thing recently. And in America, a CT scan would cost thousands, right? Right. But all I know is I was in this tube for 10 minutes and thank you very much. Off you go. I don't get a bill. I just wander off. And one of the ideas a friend of mine had a while ago was we could value our NHS, National Health Service, more if we received a bill every time we got a service by email. We don't need to slow, you know, just after we've gone. And we get an email later that day that goes, your CT scan was £6,000. Paid for by the NHS minus £6,000, net bill zero every single time. So what I'm interested in is when you say there's a carbon tax, I'm making the assumption, you can clarify if I'm wrong, that that's a tax per household, per premises, and they must have a way of calculating I'm not sure, we use things called BTUs for gas over here. I'm not sure. So BTUs or kilowatt hours for electricity. I'm not sure if they then convert that into tons of carbon and say your house used 0.64 tons of carbon and here's your carbon tax bill. Because then it becomes visible. So there's also the behavior change piece about people knowing their impact. You know?
Yeah, the carbon tax here is applied at the point of sale. So like when you get a bill from the natural gas company, if you used X number of BTUs, it would show you the number of BTUs used, and then there'd be a line on your bill that would show how much carbon tax should be on it. So, it's visible. When you go to fill up at the gas station, the bill that comes out, it shows the amount of tax that's on it in the carbon tax. So it's visible. And it's also the part I sort of wrestle with is it's also somewhat refundable. Like we don't want to get too much detail here, but, when you get a rebate on your income tax. So based on the amount of carbon the standard person uses. So theoretically, if you take measures to reduce your carbon footprint, you're not paying the tax. If you paid it, but you get it back. I don't know if you just follow me there. So it's a refundable thing, but it's refundable just based on a fixed amount. So the opportunity is if you use less, theoretically, you make money on it.
First of all, I had not heard of that in any country before that you visibly see at point of sale. I don't know, and often it may be an issue of people changing their point of sale systems with the printouts of receipts. But if you pay for X amount of gallons or liters of petrol or diesel at the pump, it'd be really interesting if you then had a standardized way of getting that invoice, whether it's from your natural gas company or from the gas station, and you just go, you've used so much carbon at so much per ton. And therefore, if there became a political thing about we're putting the price per ton up, people would see it. But I'm guessing what they normally they'll just see is it's like 50 cents for carbon tax or
right. Yeah.
So that's interesting. And then if people, that means that you're, whether it's provincial or federal, I'm not sure, but in Canada, what's happening is you're way ahead of the UK on that one, for example, because you're already letting people see at the point of use what their carbon impact is. And I think that's really cool. And I think one of the things is just, when I do these podcasts every week, get guests from all kinds of different backgrounds, all kinds of different countries. And listening to you, we've never had a detail because last few years when we were working, it's mostly been on the charity, which is a different kind of conversation. But it's fascinating to get in some depth with you about what you're doing and actually taking, your decades of experience in consulting around engineering, particularly in energy and resources, are now going, okay, how can we look at energy differently? How can I pivot that stuff? So it's really cool. And have fun with the geothermal, because it's still reasonably cutting edge, bleeding edge stuff. The UK, what they do is they're subsidizing people to change to ground source heat pumps, right? Which is basically the same thing, right? And just like the early days of any technology, there's a load of fly-by-night There's a lot of businesses operating in that space who really don't know what they're doing at a residential level. But they've already declared here that you will not be able to have a gas boiler. We don't have basement furnaces here, but we have combi boilers in most houses, which are instant on gas boilers for heating and hot water, even quite large houses. But you won't be able to buy one in a number of years. They already announced it. So they're trying to move people towards this, but I know a few people have done it and they're having, particularly when it gets really cold, which in Alberta, it can get way colder than the UK. They struggle. There's only so much. So, and I know the engineer in you will just love playing with the technology and tuning it when you get into your house. Just don't let your family hear this audio going, what are you getting us into, Kirk?
Well, I will say the geothermal, a friend of mine did geothermal probably 10 years ago and he loved it, but he had trouble getting parts for it.
Yeah. It
broke down over Christmas. He had trouble getting parts. I think that the technology is simple. Like I think I learned it in thermal dynamics back in about 1979. You're correct. It's not as widespread. It doesn't have as much widespread use.
But I'm sure I'll talk to you about it offline at some point once you move into your house. I guess at some stage later this year or early the following year, depending how it goes. Meanwhile, I realize we've been running a fair bit of time, so it seemed like a good point to pause. What we like is to get the audience half an hour with a different guest every week and just get some different thoughts and stuff. So I really appreciate you coming on and sharing what you've been focused on. And I imagine this will develop into the next projects, the next part of the conversation of the Energy Remix. Plus, you've got your house to build. So that's very cool. I always like to give the guest the last words on whatever their thoughts might be. So I'll hand over to you and then we'll say goodbye. So whatever you want to chat about to finish off.
Oh, no, Tom, I think, it was just fun doing that. I'd be happy to, share. I'll send you my slide on my economics on my house. And then I'll just point out that our work on the Canadian Energy and Climate Nexus project, you can find that. We do regular updates on my LinkedIn page and as well as the Canadian Energy and Climate Nexus LinkedIn page.
Canadian Energy and Climate Nexus.
Climate Nexus, yes. And I can certainly send you the links. So we expect to be done probably a Q2 this year, have a report done. And
it would seem that Canada has a lot to learn from the Canadian Climate and Energy Nexus's work. Your industry does, but also there's the world can be learning from Canada on this. So, and I know you're a proud Canadian and you feel that there's a lot of leadership in your space that Canada can share. So it's great to see you doing all of that. So, retirement, you're not retired. You've just rewired.
Yeah, refocused.
Refocused and yeah. Full of energy and no doubt still playing basketball and golf and all kinds and skiing and all kinds of
that's
stuff.
Right, so. Yeah, that's right.
Okay. Absolute pleasure, Kirk. Yeah. Thank you very much.
Okay. Take care, Tom. Stay safe.